everyone, welcome to the first episode of the Flackcast. Today we are joined by Fulbright scholar Anne Driscoll of the NUIG Innocence Project to talk about wrongful convictions. Thank you very much for coming today, Anne.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here.
Of course. So could I just ask, how did you get started in wrongful convictions?
Well, I had always wanted to write, but that seemed like a really preposterous career choice. So I decided I would become a social worker. And the first job I got out of college was working with girls that had been involved with the courts. And I did that for a few years. I really enjoyed it. But ultimately, I decided I still really wanted to write. And so basically, I did whatever I could to get work writing. And at one point, I had 7 part-time jobs. One of them was making all-natural dog biscuits and selling them at craft fairs. And a reporter from a daily newspaper came and interviewed me and told me they were looking for somebody to cover court. And nobody wanted to do that job because they thought court was boring. And I had spent a lot of time in court with the girls. I knew court was not boring, and great stories happen in court, and it's great theater. So anyways, I ended up getting that job. And then years later, a friend of mine, I was part of a women journalism group, and one of the women in the group said that she was going to start an institute for investigative journalism to look at issues of human rights and social justice. And one of the projects she had in mind was an innocence project. And since she knew that I had worked covering court and I had worked with girls that were involved in the court system, she asked me if I would be part of that project. And so that was in 2006. And that's how I started getting interested in innocence issues and started working, investigating wrongful convictions. And so that was how it began.
Wow, that's a really interesting path because it's not the traditional.
Not path at all,
especially going from selling dog biscuits at one point to being involved in something so important and huge. So could I just ask you, is there any particular stories or instances that really stood out to you when you were working with the Innocence Project? Maybe a really good breakthrough in a case or something that meant a lot to you, particular story of someone who was wrongfully convicted?
Yeah. Well, I worked on the case of a man by the name of Angel Echeverria. And ultimately, he was in prison for 21 years of his life for a murder he did not commit. And I got to know Angel over time. I used to visit him in prison. And, you know, he was a very shy person and very quiet. And, you know, he would cover up his mouth whenever he would speak to me. And in part, I knew it was because he was shy. In part, it was because he was a native Spanish speaker and he didn't really have much English. So he was very self-conscious about that. But the other reason was that, you know, his dental care in prison was so poor that he had lost most of the teeth that he had. And, you know, so anyways, I developed a relationship with him in that it's just kind of a unique relationship. It's you're in effect, and you know, part of this goes back to my training as a social worker. As a social worker, you're trained to be a witness for someone. You know, you're acting as a witness for what they've experienced. And you do the same as a reporter as well. But in this case, it's a very special relationship because you're acting for a witness that essentially no one believes. So long story short, it ultimately took almost 10 years to prove his innocence. And one of the things that I had been looking for is Angel was tried with a co-defendant. And the judge, well, let me just step back. Both of them were convicted. The jury convicted both of them. But immediately after the jury came back with their verdict, the judge threw out the conviction against the co-defendant, but Angel's case remained. And the only difference was that in this case, the witness, the key eyewitness, and this was basically a drug execution in a drug house, and the key eyewitness was the brother of the victim, the murder victim. And this was somebody who couldn't tell time. He couldn't tell weight. He couldn't tell distance, what town he was in, what his birthday was. And this was the key eyewitness. And because his testimony was so poor, the judge threw out the conviction against the co-defendant. But there was, in Angel's case, there was one more ID. And the ID was a man who had been approached by the police a year after the murder. And this state police trooper went to visit a witness. And this guy was facing armed robbery charges. Now, what that cop said to that person in this one-on-one meeting, there's no record of it. We don't know. All we know is that at the end of it, he ID'd Angel, and he wrote on the back of that photo, "I couldn't swear to this." Wow. He did not ID the co-defendant. And he did admit that he only saw these people. He was in the apartment when these intruders came in to execute this guy. He admitted he only saw him 2 seconds. So that 2 seconds was the difference between having your conviction thrown out or having it stay. So we were desperate to find the file of the co-defendant. And, you know, the lawyer who represented the co-defendant, he was a really, really good lawyer. Angel, unfortunately, had a horrible attorney. In fact, he was being investigated on 13 counts of fraud while Angel's trial was going on, and Angel didn't know anything about that. So the co-defendant's attorney, he knew that Angel had gotten screwed, and he actually went to his grave complaining about what had happened to Angel. But after he died, no one knew what happened to that co-defendant's file, and we were really desperate to find it. And I tried everything I could. And I guess this is kind of an example of how determined you have to be and how, you know, the distance you have to go in order to, because these cases are not easy to prove. So I finally was able to find a lawyer who had been in practice with the deceased lawyer, the deceased defense lawyer, and he thought he knew where the file might be, and he thought it would be in the basement of this law office, where the law office used to be. But unfortunately, it had a flood, and he wasn't sure if there was any files left down there. And we arranged to meet this one day. The day that I was going to meet him, I pulled up out in front of the law office. And I never have done this in my life, and I haven't done it since, but I shut off my car and I said, "Dear God, please help me find this file. I really need to find this file." And I went in, met the lawyer. We went to the door to the basement. The lock had been broken. We went down there, and there were like 5 storage units. And we went into the one where he thought that this, you know, the law office files were held, but there were maybe 5 banker's boxes. And he said, "Let's go. There's nothing here." And I said, "Well, wait, there's a filing cabinet in the corner." And he looked and there wasn't anything. And he said, "Come on, let's go." And I said, "Wait." I said, "One of the boxes says Ron on it." And that was the name of the lawyer. He opened up the box, files in it. The first file he pulled out was the one we were looking for. And it ended up having proof of Angel's alibi.
Oh my gosh, that yeah, really does
it
go
was,
to show.
I literally started crying because it was, I knew the significance of it and I knew the improbability of us actually finding that file. So, maybe I should pray more often. I don't know.
Well, your prayers were certainly answered there anyways.
Yeah.
That really does just go to show the persistence it takes, as you said, in securing ultimately someone's freedom and giving them their life back, mm-hmm. which is, it's crazy to think that one file could be so crucial mm-hmm. to someone's entire life. And
it did give Angel back his life. And, I can now say, it's, I can't express the kind of satisfaction and happiness it gives me to see Angel, who now has this beautiful smile because a friend of mine who kind of took on the role of Angel to Angel, she found a dentist who was willing to do work for him, dental work for him, completely pro bono. So he has a complete set of new teeth and he's so happy. You know, while he was in prison, his mother died, the mother of his children died, and he's, you know, not only got a great smile now, but he's reconnected with all of his children. He married a woman that he had been involved with before all of this happened. They reconnected. And so it's wonderful to see that, you know, there's no way to make up for those 21 years that he lost, but at least he now has a future.
Exactly. I totally agree. And it really shows the amazing work that the Innocence Project does and the work that you do with them. So that's a lovely story. Thank you. So I thought what we might do now is maybe debunk some common misconceptions about wrongful convictions. Mm-hmm. So the first myth is that only guilty people confess.
Oh, well, that's so wrong. You know, we really didn't know how often wrongful convictions happen until DNA started being used in the court system. And when that happened, it's really strong empirical proof of guilt, but it's also really strong empirical proof of innocence. And that gave us a clue that, wow, you know, all this blind faith that we're having in blind justice is not that well placed, because this happens far more often than we imagined. And then we started really looking at how this happens and doing the research about why this happens. And what we now know is that 25% of the cases in which DNA has proved somebody to be innocent, there's been a false confession. And, you know, that sounds very counterintuitive. Why would anyone confess to something they didn't do? But the truth is that, you know, very often these are people who maybe are young, who maybe have mental issues, or maybe none of those things apply. They're just in a terrible situation. They are in a police station and they're being pressured or coerced, or even, I mean, there are cases where people have been beaten and they just want to get out of there. And so, right or wrong, they might reason to themselves, well, look, I'm just going to tell them whatever they want to know, whatever they say, because I know in my heart I'm innocent. So how could they ever prove that I'm guilty if I'm innocent? But that's not really the way it works.
Exactly. And I think it's very easy to be coerced into doing something. We all know we've had experiences of even going through airport security, and you can feel a bit like uneasy when they're like asking you things at customs or something like that. And you can imagine how in such a intense setting, how things like that could easily happen, especially when there's misconduct in the police. So the next myth is, I think, one that a lot of people would have, which is eyewitness evidence is the best evidence. Oh.
Well, eyewitness evidence is the most common cause of wrongful conviction, actually. And believe it or not, 75% of the cases that have been overturned based on DNA evidence involve eyewitness misidentification. So, you know, people have this idea that, like, you see something and, you know, your mind records it like some sort of video recorder. But that's not really the way our minds or memory work. You know, when you think about it, many crimes, they happen at night, they happen in the dark, they happen quickly. You know, you're likely to be under stress. And if there's a weapon involved, you're probably focused, your focus is on that weapon, not on, you know, what color hair the person has or what they're wearing. You're focused on that weapon, and all of those things can impair your ability to remember things correctly later. But, and, you know, it's human nature, but juries really believe eyewitnesses. And the thing is, they can be very convincing, even if they're completely wrong about what they remember. And there's been many cases like that. So, and you know, what often happens is a witness or a victim may become even more convinced of what they think they remember. the more they retell it. And so that in turn becomes that much more convincing to the jury. So it is an issue, and it is a myth that eyewitnesses make the best identifications. You know, I was the victim of a mugging myself, and I know firsthand how difficult that is. Even as much as I know about memory and recollection, it's very difficult to accurately recall something later, especially when you're a victim of a crime.
Yeah, and there's actually been, I'm sure you've seen, quite a number of videos online where you have to watch and see if you can see the person. Or I saw one where it was basically five or six men passing a basketball, and it said, how many times has the ball been thrown? And you're sitting there thinking, okay, six times, it's definitely been six times, and it comes up saying six, and you're like, I got it right. And then there's a gorilla actually coming into the middle of it. Right. Have you seen that one?
I've heard about it. Yeah. I haven't seen it, but I heard about
it. It's very good. It really shows how much you can miss something so blatantly obvious, but you think, oh, I'm right. Like,
yeah.
I mean, the human eye, I don't know much about the scientific area of it, but you can be wrong. And I think as humans, as you said, in human nature, it's very easy to just believe what another person saw as fact when mm-hmm. it's really not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think another myth, which I thought was quite interesting and maybe a bit controversial, was that it dishonors a victim to question
the verdict.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand why people might think that, but I don't really agree with it because, you know, in my mind, anytime there's a wrongful conviction, it's at least a double miscarriage of justice, because on the one hand, the wrong person has been convicted and sentenced and probably in very often jailed for something they didn't do. At the same time, the person who actually committed the crime, and this is the double miscarriage of justice, is not held accountable. And we know for a fact that all too often they're free to commit other crimes, in maybe even worse crimes. So, but I also think that it's actually a triple miscarriage of justice, because the family or the victim, you know, the family of the victim or the victim has this false sense of closure that, that justice has been served, when the truth is justice has not been served. So, it's not good enough just to aim for a conviction. We have to try and aim for justice.
I agree. And I suppose one of the final myths, and probably one of the biggest ones, given a lot of the population's trust in the system, is that the system never convicts an innocent person. Which, well, as we know, is not true.
We know that is not true. And as I said before, a lot of that is a result of what we've learned since the introduction of DNA evidence. It's really hard to know exactly how often this happens, but the best research we have suggests that anywhere between 2.3 and maybe even as high as 10% of all convictions are actually of innocent people. And that's astounding because, you know, in America, for example, and I have to say that this is based on American research, but there's no reason to believe that this isn't relevant in other countries as well, because wrongful convictions happen in every jurisdiction. They can happen to anybody, anywhere, anytime, and they do. So in America, for example, you know, this is not something I say with any sort of pride. It's quite a shameful statistic. We have 2.3 million people in prison right now. And so, you know, if you extrapolate 10% of that population, that is a huge number. You know, there aren't enough innocence projects around to tackle that kind of number. So, yeah, sadly, it happens far more often than it should.
And what do you think is the best way of tackling, besides innocence projects? Obviously, that's probably one of the main ways. But what about taking preventative measures to ensure that these things don't happen?
I think it's far better that we do a better job of preventing these wrongful convictions from happening than taking them off afterwards, because it takes years and years to get remedy in the courts. But we know that there are some simple things that we could do that would prevent that. For example, the ways that we conduct, say, a photo ID. You know, if we show photos sequentially instead of in an array, if we do a double blind showing so that, say, the policeman who's doing the ID with the victim or the witness doesn't know who the suspect is, because, you know, there are unconscious ways that they can influence an ID like that. So those are some really simple remedies that would go a long way to preventing wrongful convictions from happening. I think that we also, you know, could do much more in terms of, at least in America, holding prosecutors accountable. Because right now, in America especially, prosecutors and many sheriffs, they're elected officials, which makes them politicians. And if they brag that they have a 95% conviction rate or arrest rate, that sounds good to the average voter. But what the average voter might not think to ask themselves is, what was that prosecutor or sheriff willing to do in order to get that 95% conviction rate or arrest rate? Were they willing to use snitch evidence? Were they willing to use shaky or faulty scientific evidence? Were they willing to use evidence they knew to be false? So all of those things, you know, increase the likelihood that there's going to be a wrongful conviction. And we have to do a better job of making sure that prosecutors aren't just trying to get the conviction, that they're actually trying to get justice.
Exactly, because I think they have great responsibility, but they're not really held accountable. Mm-hmm. There's great responsibility, but little accountability. Mm-hmm. And maybe greater oversight would benefit the system a bit more in reducing wrongful convictions.
Absolutely.
So I suppose now just moving on to the last question, which is about the NUIG Innocence Project. Mm-hmm. So you came to start this year.
Yeah.
And could you just tell us a little bit about what case you're investigating and how the mix of journalism and law students has benefited the project?
Yeah. I suppose by way of background, I should say that I first arrived in Ireland in September of 2013, and I was selected as a U.S. Fulbright scholar to work with the Irish Innocence Project at Griffith College. And at the time that I arrived, only law students were working there and as caseworkers and investigators. And it seemed to me that it might be helpful to sort of teach the law students how to investigate and how to interview and use journalism techniques to advance their cases. And within, you know, a month or two of my arrival, the then director recognized that this was a skill set that was really helpful. And since Griffith had a journalism program as well, the project was opened up to both journalism and law students. And so, you know, that turned out to be a really effective model, I think, because there are very different but complementary skills involved for students that study law and students that study journalism. And then my last year there, I was contacted by Larry Donnelly, who runs the clinical law program here, and he was asking me if I would accept a couple of NUIG students at Griffith because they really wanted to work on the Innocence Project. And I said, sure, you know, but it means that they're going to have to travel across the country at least some of the time to attend meetings and meet with their team and blah, blah, blah. And they were willing to do that. And it turned out to be wonderful. They were a huge asset to the project. And, you know, they really added a lot. And I think that they really enjoyed their experience. But it also made me realize that students shouldn't have to travel across the country to be able to get that the benefit of that opportunity. So I then applied for a second Fulbright. And again, the idea was to open it up to law and journalism and even human rights. And, you know, we have psychology and sociology students. So, you know, it's been, to me, a really exciting opportunity. And so first semester, essentially I was teaching those students, and I had no idea how many students would sign up because it had obviously never been done here before. And truthfully, I would have been happy if we had a dozen students. But in the end, 97 students signed up, which I was really blown away by. And so the intention was really to teach them about wrongful convictions, you know, how they happen, why they happen, ways to prevent them. But then use, and as well as like the journalism skills that you could apply to those cases. And then second semester, actually work on a case. And because President Michael D. Higgins had given what was the second posthumous presidential pardon to Miles Joyce last year, almost exactly a year ago, I was aware of that case, and I was aware that there were four other innocent men who had pled guilty, but were actually innocent. And, you know, their cases, they hadn't been pardoned. So I felt like this was a really meaty case because there's so many issues, issues that are still relevant today that we still see happening in wrongful convictions cases today. Even though it's a historical case, I think that there are lessons to be learned that are very valuable today. And, you know, so that's the case that we've been focused on. And also I think it's relevant because, you know, it's a case out of the West, the Mom Trosner murder case. And, you know, the issue of some of the men being Irish, native Irish language speakers and having their trials be held in English, I think is an issue that is important, especially in the West. So for those reasons, we focused on that case. And it's been really exciting because there's been so much interest in that case. You know, there was a recent documentary, not only the person that did the documentary, but the Sean O'Curran, the man that wrote the book on which the documentary was based, they visited the class. Sean actually took students out to Mom Trosner to show us, you know, where the murders happened, you know, where the witnesses supposedly followed the murderers over a 3-mile course, where Miles Joyce's house was. And we even got to meet with one of the descendants of both. He happens to be both a descendant of Miles Joyce and of one of the guilty parties who was hanged in this case. So,
wow, that seems like an incredible experience for students that I'm sure they could have only ever dreamed of having, but is a reality now. So I think I'm just going to wrap it up with something I heard from the founder of the Irish Innocence Project, which was, law should not be about the pursuit of result or conviction. It should be about the pursuit of the truth. Mm-hmm. And I think that really goes to the work of the Innocence Project and your incredible work with them. So thank you so, so much for coming on the podcast today. I've learned a lot. I'm sure the listeners have learned a lot. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting me.